Good morning. How's your heart, dude?
My heart is steady, I would say. How's your heart?
Boy, I wasn't prepared to be asked the question that I asked. I don't know. Okay, I'm a little groggy. I didn't sleep well last night, and I usually sleep well, but when I don't sleep well, it's no fun at all.
Yeah.
And the boy woke up, and I think I just got the boy woke up in the night, and I, you know, you would think we should take turns getting the boy up, and it's fine. But then, you know, Kendra will kind of, you know, smack me and say, go check on him. And then I'll say, okay. And then I'll hear her get up to go to the bathroom. And I have this, you know, this thing in the back of my head, like, well, if you were going to get up anyway, why should I, you know, why don't you just get up? Why do I have to get up? And,
well, the bathroom's a sure thing. You pee and then you go back to bed.
Yeah.
The other one. Yeah. You pee and then you go to Ezra and then it's like, I don't want to lose that 15, 20 minutes. You go do it, baby.
No. It's never 15. Well, it can be. I don't know. It shouldn't be.
Oh, right on. Well, yeah.
I imagine it's not going to be 15, 20 minutes. He squeaks in the night and you go pat him on the head and you say, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's not going to be 15, 20 minutes. You just say, oh, that's okay. Yeah, that's a good boy. Okay. And then you go back to sleep. Maybe, but you're not wrong. But anyway, I've built up this thing in my head where it's like, you're going to get up anyway. You don't sleep. You don't go to sleep. You're going to get up. Even though you made me get up, one of us could keep sleeping. You're going to get up no matter what happens. And then finally last night, you know, in my stupor of sleep, and I'm a dick about waking up in the night. It's not a time when I'm at my healthiest if I'm awoken. And so I like said something stupid like, you're just going to get up anyway. And then whatever that wasn't, I think she said literally nothing to in return to that. And then I just went and, you know, tended to the boy for a moment and then she didn't get up for a moment, maybe for the first time ever, which is of course, because I said, you're going to get up anyway. Because I've noted it like 1,000 times in a row before I was ready to say something, you know, useless, unreasonable, and unkind. And then she didn't get up for a while. And then we lied in bed for a moment. And then I'm partially, you know, of course my blood is poisoned a little bit from just having been a dick for a second. You know, some combination of, you know, then the indignance, like, okay, I said a thing and do I just like immediately regret it or can I hold on to it for a little bit longer to justify it? I have to maintain some indignance because I'm not, I'm not ready to just be wrong yet at 2 o'clock in the morning. And then I go back to bed sort of. And then I toss and turn for a bit. And then he squeaks again. And then she gets up anyway, because we all know eventually she was going to get up anyway. And one way or another. And then eventually she came back to bed. And then we just lied there awake for the next, you know, couple hours, to the point where we eventually went back to like looking at our phones, or she's listening to an audiobook, or, you know, at now 2:33 o'clock in the morning or something.
Uh-huh.
To try and get ourselves to fall back to sleep, and so you know, I'm tired, and
yeah, and raising children, I was probably more on the side of Kendra and Aurora, lighter sleeper than myself, and I also do very badly when I'm woken up, and I wish I had been a little more obedient and submissive to that whole process, because there's something about the exchange and the wee hours, despite the loss of sleep with our children, that just, it's very deep. And when I did wake up and do it and got over myself, I always appreciated, I mean, obviously the dynamics were slightly different between Aurora and I, but similar stuff, somewhat. And I just in many ways try to not spend too much time in regret around my inability to be submissive to being, you know, whatever, the lowest and aware and get up because this time is going to pass. And I, yeah, then there's so many moments like that, that I just have to then be like, well, today, let there not be, like, if Asha wants a coffee and I'm up on the roof and I can feel this call to go and do, well, just do it. Just drop what you're doing, go do it, you know? And I really have tried, but as a young father, what is it called in the Bible? It kicked against the goads. It's a funny expression. Like, I just, like a mule, I just kind of like, it's such a funny expression, but you're just like, yeah, I do that. It's just like, it's kind of stubbornness. And I just think there's such a sweetness in, yeah, and you getting up, like in fighting that tendency. And the fact that it happened hundreds of times before or whatever the number, and then this breaking point, then it just wonders, I wonder about the nature of all those deeds that were done prior, where there was this, of course there's virtue, but it's a sort of a mixed karma, you know, it's a good, you know. And then I wonder, well, then what is it to plant a pure seed with an impure apparatus? And obedience just keeps coming in for me. And this sweet submission that is the hardest in the middle of the night. I am terrible, bro. Like, listen, kid.
Yeah. I mean, there's only so much that it's fair to ask at that time.
It's the worst.
I mean, in anyone's
it's only
defense,
so much. It's totally.
I'm so, if ever I'm an automaton, you know, if ever
I am
helplessly programmed, but to spit out whatever this machine will spit out, it's at its most obvious in the middle of the night.
And what a self-denial, yeah. What an act of self-denial it is that to me, upon which hinges spiritual freedom and awakening to everything. Like, it's this great opportunity, you know, where for one cat, it's just a big old trial. And for another, that trial is somehow just pure. Well, that's good. You're being woken up by God in the form of your child to, like, see if you can hold the line when you're at your worst. You
well, God knows exactly how well I'm going to do with that. I mean, that's, you know, what well, you know, I can't, you know.
Can you improve? Is there a way to do it differently? Are you telling me that it can't be evolved?
Sure. I mean, and I'm helpless but to evolve through that process or devolve through that process. I may have devolved to this point.
That's my,
you know, that's what happened last night, you know, as I devolved to the point of, like, actually just, you know, saying something shitty before going to tend to my child,
right.
As opposed to just thinking something shitty. And maybe if I just thought something shitty, then I would have, you know, been able to get back to sleep. But saying something shitty, you know, brought me below whatever baseline of health would have been necessary to be able to go back to sleep.
But the maintenance of the baseline is not necessarily going to create evolution. So the devolution can actually create in Kendra a kind of, like, you know, he's kind of got a point. Oh, now we have something to kind of work on here, sweetie. Like, hundreds, this is what happens. This is the pattern I see. No, and I had to bring it out into the light. And I'm sorry I did it. I was grumpy. And yet, so then that becomes a portal, if you will, again, into some sort of evolutionary possibility. I mean, with the help of angels and other invisibles. But I just, that, you know, because just not speaking, of course, we'd like to speak in a manner from a place that isn't angry or frustrated or just woken up. Like, but at the same time, I just want there to be room for that kind of, like, what the fuck, babe? You know, and that kind of banter so that, like, Aurora and I can really be like, what the fuck? Like that. We can kind of be tough with each other. We can be tough with each other like that. Come on, man. I've done this like the last five, you know. And you're like, you know, and there might be a little spark or, and now with all the years of keeping the book, of just keeping our vows together, like, where the recovery time is quicker And sometimes I feel like that little spat, that little thing from the grease pops up from the pan and you get a little, is part of the evolution of a woman and a man to get or partners, you know? And I feel that with you, you know, I feel like there has to be room for that, or else I don't feel
safe. Well, there's this nice, there's this interesting question about, you know, and we, you know, we had a teacher who taught us something that I think that we both strongly disagree with, but that is not unsubtle in its, you know, it was just the way, the way that it was presented was sort of like, you don't need to talk to your partner about stuff.
That's right.
It's, you know, you work it out in your heart. And that's the battleground to do this thing. And so why talk to them?
Your partner will change. Yeah.
And that, you know, doesn't work in my heart per se. But there's something not insignificant to that statement. Like on the surface, I think that it's an overstatement. And maybe it can work for some people. And maybe it worked for me on some level because I am incapable of not talking to my partner. So maybe it was just going to shift the balance. But here I work myself. I'm going to say something to her. You know, I work this up for so long. And then finally, like, you know, I say something. And then it's like, well, great. How'd that go for you? You know, now you get a taste. Now you get to see how well that went. And it's not that I shouldn't, you know, there are times when I should say something. But the number of times that I get excited about finally saying something and then like, that I think is going to fix the thing. If I just say something, then that'll fix the thing.
And it doesn't fix the thing. Yeah.
And it doesn't fix, well, right. Yeah. Better yet. I mean, it, you know, keeps you awake for several hours. And this morning I was crazy this morning. I was so tired this morning. I was like making Ezra a sandwich and I'm like, you know, moving dishes around. And I'm like, I use this. I like cleaned this spot with like a rag in the kitchen. And then I threw the rag in the sink and turned on the sink. And I'm like, what the hell are you doing?
Executive function out the window systematizing or sequencing. I don't even usually have to think about this. I just do it.
Right. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
But again, holding out and trusting in that process, which I think, you know, trusting in that the process of like letting it out sometimes like that, and I mean, you've taught me to, I would let it out without control and with anger and still do sometimes and less and less though, and so it is a battle. It is certainly a battle worth. I mean, gosh, what a wonderful battle to fight, I think, you know, like, sweetie, I do have to mention this. Now, I'm going to mention this in a nice way, and it's still probably not going to go well.
Yeah.
See, that's the other thing. Like you meant, but we go away and cook it. I'm proud, right? Me and my wounded pride go away and I cook it a little bit alone. And then it does soften the rough edges. You know, it does iron the wrinkles in the heart. It does polish the facet of the diamond. It does do something to like smooth the prana in the body and make peaceful and tranquil the mind and good for the work we want. You know, it can have that effect. By like Aurora,
well, if there are things you need to say, right? Yeah. Because you need to ease your heart, because there's going to be something on your heart. If you don't say a thing, that's going to cause more disharmony, right? If you have this thing on your heart, then probably need to say, is that what you're thinking? An interesting test of whether or not it's time to say something is, are you saying it for the sake of easing hearts? Is that what's happening right now?
Oh, now you said hearts. Yeah, it can't just be my heart. Yeah, for easing hearts.
If it's easing your heart. I mean, I don't know, you know, in a marriage, you can't really do one without the other. But that's the thing. Is it in that knowledge, right? That this is to create ease of heart.
At least in that intention. Yeah. At least in the intention.
Is that why I'm doing it? Or am I doing it so that I don't have to get up when the kid squeaks? You know, like which one?
Or am I
trying to get?
Yes, or am I doing it just as a scorekeeping mechanism that just is sort of lost in tit for tat and making sure everything's nice and even and making sure like when you have buddies who you know, some friends are very aware of who's paid for what, and da, 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 and then some folks just kind of give and then don't really worry about it and let God do the balancing. And I, you know, just even giving up the balancing act, like, yo, baby, I know you're taking care of everything you need to be. But along those lines, the Lord took me to task. I am carving out a life where I work 5-6 hours of labor a day and then practice the piano and take care of the home and stay in touch with the children and do various things and have odd jobs right now in this COVID time. I'm working out this kind of almost like a householder retreat work-life combination, which our teacher indeed encouraged. And Aurora was like, hey, this project on the house is taking too long. No, it's just you actually need to knock this out now. And I'm like, what? Wait, no. I mean, this is so I did a similar woken out of sleep. I was kind of like the whole rhythm I was in, I was woken out of, and she was like, this is actually what I need. And you know, and I kicked against the goads. And I let slip my tongue and lost control of it, just, but not, we didn't, you know, not yelling, but just like sharp, like what you're talking about in this discreet. So it's like, but it was good. She had to let that out. And then I had to explain what it was I was doing. And then she got a greater understanding of the project, because she's serving Asha right now as my mother-in-law is dying of brain cancer. So we have this amazing time of serving, so we don't really look at each other much or get to reflect our intimacy or love, because we're in caretaking, you know, her sisters and her mother, and people are coming to the home. And it's just, it's kind of so it was good, because it sort of let off the pressure for her to let that out. And then I just was like, you know what, I'll just work a couple of long, you know, a few 10-hour days and just knock a bunch of stuff out, you know, and try to really be like, oh, that means there's less time for spiritual reading and less time for physical asana and less time for music practice and less time for writing up a bid and whatever it is, you know? And so, I don't know, just I definitely have been in the same boat as you, vibration, with my wife in the last 72 hours. And I find it hard sometimes to just submit in a way that's not like, oh, all okay, you know? Not like that.
Sure.
But joyfully you know, submit.
That's hard. And, you know, like you say, you know, there's this special thing. It's about raising a child. And I can see, even from my vantage, this thing about having raised a child, that you come to miss and treasure the even the hard parts later. You're like, oh, if I could only have the hard parts back. You know, I feel like I hear that sentiment from you a lot, you know, like, oh, you know, what I wouldn't
you
give
do,
to go back
yeah.
and partake of.
Thanks
the hard
for bringing
parts.
Us back to the children, especially the hard parts, because they have such a karmic power to purify the false self. There's such a power in that. You mean risen out of deep sleep, and still you're in the love prayer? You're still, because you're dreaming Dharma? You're hearing, like, no, I never got it. It was always just impossible for me to get up in the middle of the night, bro.
Well, is going through at that phase, you know, when they have a small child, and that it's just the nature of the rhythm of life that typically, however old one is or isn't at that time, you know, what sort of is the normal, at least American experience, is when a man has a 5-year-old child, you know, that no reason it should be a man, you know, but when parents have a 5-year-old, that they are in the throes of hard work to sustain and to prepare for the future, you know, you're on the precipice of a kaleidoscope of exciting expenses that lay ahead on the road. And
you're constantly
prepared
tired.
Yeah, right.
At least for the first few years. At least for
you're
the
just
first
getting
few
your ass kicked. You're just you're grinding just, yeah. it out.
Oh, yeah.
Because you don't know what is it going to take to be prepared for all this. Do we have enough, you know, can you know, the kid's going to go to school someday, or they're going to, you know, you have to be preparing for all these things. What is it all going to involve? And so it's not like, yeah, if Kevin now, you know, with, you know, your son is out of the house, he's in New Mexico, I'm going to see him in 10 days. I'm
going to see good.
Him in 10 days.
Uh-huh. Oh, good.
And then your daughter's in at college.
Yeah, North Carolina.
And, and then, yeah, for you to be, I mean, I tear up to think of it myself, you know, it's a good perspective for me to have, you know, like,
oh,
yeah.
Or just when they're like, tug on you and go, come swim in the pond. Now, my wife reminds me that a lot of times I was just the guy in the sea and in the pond and in the trees with the kids. So she said, don't go. And that those times when you said no were times often of replenishment for yourself, you know, at the piano or whatever. Like, so careful with your Monday morning quarterbacking mentality, where like your notion of an ideal of, you know, submission to this, being obedient to the moment and finding joy in this, a potential trial of like, well, damn it, I just made my coffee. I'm sitting down on the porch. I was just about to hang out with her. And now you want to go down to the pond. We were just down at the pond. I mean,
well,
you know, like that.
So you and Kendra share, you know, and maybe Aurora and I share, although, you know, in a, whatever, just in our respective roles, just, you know, because we're comparing our relationships, I, you know,
yeah.
I think that Aurora probably in a lot of ways is a more practically driven person than me. But I still think that I play that role in my relationship with Kendra in some ways, where I think that you and she are more natural to play and more natural to make space for play, which is not to say that Aurora doesn't or that I don't.
Well, definitely. I mean, Aurora, you're not going to find her swimming in the pond and in the ocean. She'll be sitting under the umbrella, making sure everybody, including everyone on the beach, is safe. Like she's like a lifeguard, totally relaxed, totally has this mystical relaxation, the ability to let go in the moment, but very much always on guard without,
you know, I take Ezra to the playground. Right. And I, you know, and I watch him kind of play and I kind of talk to him a little bit and he goes up on the slide and he climbs a thing.
Yes.
And, but mom's on the jungle gym with him, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's, Kendra and I are right up the same alley.
Right.
Yeah. That's
right,
very
exactly.
accurate. You make a perfect comparison between our relationships here.
And so it's a different thing, you know, were Kendra to look back and say, I wish I had made more time to play with him, I would take issue. I'd have to say, look, babe, you know, in fairness, I watched you. The times when you had other things to do, but you made space for him. You know, when it was time to play with him, you played with him. You know, I think it'll be a different thing for me. I have this pull even when I ostensibly do have space, even when I'm not doing anything else. For whatever reason, I have this resistance to like hold together or be.
Yeah,
I want to be pragmatic. I want to be doing. I want to be achieving the practical things necessary to sustain the space for play.
All the while, too, though, you have stars in your eyes and you're smelling the flowers along the way. And there is a magic that we can tap into even if we're not on the jungle gym, you know, so to speak. But, I do feel that like a kind of. We have to, in our groundedness, just have that sparkle. And some of us fly, we fly in different ways or sparkle in different ways. But and I can't help but feel, though, as I feel some upward spiral out of selfishness in my life. Now, that's a dangerous thing to say. But the human that I am now could, let's put it another way, could drink of the inner sap of those moments with my children that I can never get back on a level of intimacy now that I just couldn't then because I was still caught in the idea of worldly honor or recognition or respect or notions of
who's in charge or tit for tat or keeping score or, and as those things heal, I think a soul is more conformed to reality, to the way it unfolds, so that, because what we're looking for is it's intimacy. So when you said, you know, well, yeah, bring this thing up to mend my heart or hearts. Well, hearts for me, just because it's so that we can be more intimate with the precisely the other, necessarily hearts, and where, as opposed to, you know, I got to do this for me, you know, Ben, I got to let you know, bro, that it's, and it's my heart, you know. Well, there is a place for that, but it's all, hopefully with the intention that you and I then have more reality flowing between us, more truth.
Well, which is something that I'm loath to say universally, but it seems like there's some trend in which we come to understand what's important in our lives as those things are taken away in a way that is healthy. It's not too late. It's still important. It still is healthy and profound, but as, you know, like the incredible period of friendship that we all had, and to understand the importance of friendship, partially because we had this time where we all were together and lived in each other's lap, and it was so precious. And I don't know if something like, you know, I'm not going to say it could never come again. Maybe something like that, you know, could come again, but, you know, hard to imagine in that way. And then to say, like, you have this wisdom, but, you know, that to some extent rests upon the fact that the children are not in the house. And even if they were in the house, they're not children. And to think, and I hate to bring, you know, it back to this, because I also, I know it's a heavy thing to say to a friend, but I can't help but imagine in my mind, and it helps me to think what you would give to have a squeaking child in the middle of the night that just needs your comfort. And not to do that to you. I love you, and I'm sorry to, you know, do whatever to, you know, but I have that, you know, and it's profoundly precious, and the fleeting nature of these things, you know. My friend Evan said to me recently about death that it's good that for some reason, something going on in his life that he saw that he would die and that it was good. And I'm not going to drill down too much on that, because I don't know what the hell it means to him. And then, you know, whatever, I make my own cockamamie story about what that would mean to me if I had that sentiment.
But indeed. This seems like we're always doing some version of what you just laid out. But yeah. I mean, shall we continue the podcast or no? Sorry.
Yeah. But that that our preciousness, the preciousness of life, as we've said before, and I think it's so important that so much of what spirituality is, what all our discussions are, what, you know, all of this, so much is about processing death, is about processing the fleeting nature of whatever is, and that we are precious, not in spite of death, but because of death, that we are precious to some large degree because we will die, that our moments with our children, with our moments with our family, our moments with each other are precious because they are quickly ending. And that is, as we have a tendency to like define ourselves somehow in opposition to our death, I am the opposite of death, but I'm not. I am that I will die. Our relationship as friends is that it will end. Our children are that relationship will pass on. And that is very much central to what makes that relationship so utterly precious.
At least it will come to an end as we know it. So in my habitualizing my mind to eternity by thinking constantly of death, the actions we undertake that are apparently fleeting have eternal repercussions if done only in love, or the extent to which it's conformed with love, or the extent to which it's conformed with the self and other in perfect union with whatever, you know, the colors that come into the eye, or the touches of breezes on the skin, or your child holding you, the extent to which we're, I believe there are ways that those seeds ripen such that it appears that our friendship ends, but the extent to which our friendship was tied up in eternity, it does not. And I only say that in faith and in hope. I don't say that as if I have a direct knowledge. I only say that because this is what God has promised me. This is what the religions have promised me. This is what the great books have told me, that somehow there is a way to live that is coterminous with eternity. And I believe it with all my heart. And honestly, without it, I can't. My will is ossified. My will is broken. If I think, and yet everything you just said, the fleeting nature of it is precisely what allows us to enter more creatively and openly within the unfolding of change and these things, and yeah,
well,
and I
that's
don't.
That's why I don't want to. You know, every path is sacrosanct, as you have said, or for me to leverage that.
And please.
So I have this. Although my feelings on the matter, my feelings on eternity are complex, and lie somewhere between where one might approach them as a Christian or a Buddhist, or where one might approach them as a modern materialist atheist. I think that I have an affinity for a lot of these, and I don't know that a humanist, a strict sort of, materialist humanist couldn't access a profound degree of solace and comfort even in a state of acceptance of an ending. And there are times where, and by the way, and access what a sort of eternity would be, like what are the long-term relationships in this world? Even if I'm materialist, atheist, what are the long-term ramifications on this friendship and the way that we touch each other and the way that leads us to touch other people who will touch other people who will touch other people, and so on, that there are ramifications that move on, and that I think even as a materialist, there are like idealist implications to what is the nature of mind and what is the nature of our conceptual interaction with the world, that things do exist inside us and outside of us, even just because of the nature of the working of the mind and the way that we interact with individuals who appear outside of us, but we are interacting with them as if inside our own psychology, and in a sense, those people live. And it is, there are times when it is helpful to focus on one or the other and to say, yes, this relationship will end as we know it, but it won't end. Having seen my wife, of course, just go through this, the loss of her father recently, and slowly coming to a time now in her life where she's ready to start to embrace what it means for that relationship to go on in this new way, how this relationship is being redefined now by her continued existence, and how painful and useless. I mean, it was on day two, you know, when people tell her he hasn't gone anywhere, you know, fuck you. He hasn't gone anywhere. And now you're right. And to talk now about how that relationship has gone and to say he hasn't gone anywhere, that means something different to her now and is coming to hold different meaning to her now. It's not a useless sentiment. It's just not what you say the morning that you've lost the loved one. I mean, it necessarily depends on the individual, perhaps, obviously.
But. And when I speak of eternity, of course, I'm speaking of something deeper than the psychological level and living on in memory.
I know you are.
And of course, that's a...
I know you
are. Of course, and I know you do. Of course, that's a facet, so that what you're labeling a humanist materialistic perspective, which is, I think, a perspective that every person has, a sort of Venn diagram. I mean, we all sense that we're breathing that perhaps some of the air molecules that Abraham Lincoln did, and that were actually physically the result of all kinds of, you know, the blood of red men and the blood of slaves and the blood of the Civil War is in this earth that is growing my food, everything. So there's this profound.
I don't know how much everyone senses that, dude.
And we can, well, what I mean is when you drill down materialistically, a child or when I've shared that, that's a room we can all get in. Now the room that the room on, that's a room that I've experienced in my life sharing with others.
I know that.
As people able to get into that room. So let's not say everyone can or can't. Let's just say in a apocalyptic World War driven 21st century, extremely scientifically pushed world where we have a lot of what I would say out and out materialists, I've noticed that we can get together on this atomic level. We can get, but when we get into the noetic or into the realm of thought or in the realm of ideal or into the realm of parable or into the realm of metaphor or into the realm of poetry or into the realm of theology, well, then now you're talking about stuff we cannot see. And I do not wish to go there. And that is an incredible, everything you said about eternity are facets of the understanding of eternity. I'm speaking of almost the intimacy we have now. It won't even compare to the intimacy that we have in the afterlife, to me. But only held in faith. So that it's not like...
I don't
like,
know.
That's what you're saying.
I don't know that they should have to be contradictory. And what I want to push back at is that when you talk about eternity on a deeper level, when I'm talking about what is sacrosanct, right? What you yourself has offered about the, you know, the nature of another person's path, right? Is to say that it's not that what I'm talking about that may be accessible to someone else from some other perspective is not less deep, is not less profound.
More invisible. I will say that.
I don't know that I accept that either, because it is, because the universe, even to, you know, to such a person, they can look upon and they can see a universe of apparent infinite complexity and vastness. Mm. And is it infinitely large, or is it infinitely expanding, or all of these things are so large and beyond me? And to dig into the nature of mind and my relationship in it, it's not at all unsubtle. It's not at all uncomplicated. It's not, not at all something that is easily, plumbed by the mind of,
It cannot be plumbed. It can't be actually plumbed, nor can the life of that, where this notion of eternity that I have, which I've barely laid out, is held in faith, so that they cannot be, neither can be plumbed. I don't think it's contrary to say, I guess if I add the phrase for myself, This is deeper. I don't think that using judgment or trusting in revelation, whereby we say one thing, one state of understanding is deeper than the other, that it is somehow saying that that other way of looking at the world is not sacrosanct. That is not a conclusion that I could draw from that. Now, but I appreciate you bringing it up. It doesn't mean that if I'm with somebody whose view I think I might have understood is a more materialist view, that I won't then engage with respect but and dignity. But I will try to push into depths that I don't believe that view can reach. So, but I have, yeah. But I do that with comparing
wells of infinite depth.
But the constituents are different. The constituents that make up that eternity are different. Now, interestingly, in Christianity, Jesus comes back in his resurrected Nirmanakaya risen body and asks for fish and asks for a disciple to touch him, or the disciple needs to touch him in his side. And so to me, Christianity is a mysterious solution to the atomic noetic. Flesh and spirit are no longer in a contradiction, so that the heavenly life actually is physical, and it actually is thought, and thought and physicality actually go together. And there is this, it's a life like here, except that there's a certain aspects of heaven that the Buddha teaches and Muhammad teaches and Krishna teaches and Jesus Christ teaches and Lao Tzu teaches, that there's a heaven. And here these certain things don't happen in that heaven. What? Death, for example. And so then death becomes, to go back to your thing, to me, like almost like the crown or something of our lives. It's like the, it's the crown. It's like this. Yeah. And to see Asha just losing, my mother-in-law just losing her executive function and her ability to name, and yet having the psychic and spiritual insight, and this sweet perfume of death is all over the house. And we treat each other with the way we want to treat Ezra when we wake up in the middle of the night. It's hard. Yes. We're exhausted. We've done this thing. And you're just like, oh, sweet nothing, sweet death. I don't know if the, you know, he's secular humanist, right? I don't know if the revelation is right, but I do know that bringing in this awareness has made, oh gosh, all that spiritual work that she's done, and that we've tried, and we're doing together, man. And then when I'm hurt, I call on you, bro. I call on your wisdom. I call on Rob Haggerty's wisdom. I call on Earl. I call on, I mean, it is crazy, on Lauren and Jay. I call on these people. And then I'm even believing now, because it's so hard, like that there are maybe angels, to like invisible beings to call on, and just asking for the whole help of the forest and things we can't, just to please, you know. And death just brings this clarity to it, like this outline to events, Ben, like everything flowers and your dog, everything seems so more crisp and precisely.
I have this, maybe it's like a central conviction of mine that's wrapped up in, you know, the peculiar form that Buddhism seems to have wrapped itself around me into, or that I have wrapped myself
into. Yourself around.
I'm not sure which, right? The way in which I'm intertwined.
I have this feeling about versions of reality or systems of reality or solutions to reality that that seem very different on the surface and that may not be at all. That there's some surprising overlap, that what makes an individual's path sacrosanct is hard for us to see, but that there is some vantage by which we could come to understand the way that our vernacular of conception, not of words, that's a small way to talk about conception, but our vernacular of conception fools us into to being helpless, but to favor the interpretation of reality that serves us, that functions for us, and that there are complete systems of understanding reality that are true from top to bottom and appear contradictory. And it's because we're not looking from this vantage, and that if we could come to see it, it would just be the most obvious thing in the world that these seemingly contradictory states are not at all contradictory, and that the states of understanding in spirit and science and logic and poetry, metaphor and the empirical are, when done well, they meet at this axis and
reflect and, each other. Yeah.
And are each other. Are each other descriptions of a shared reality with no sacrifice of accuracy, completeness, satisfaction, fulfillment,
specificity, particularity, singularity,
eternity, depth, and and I'm not in all of those places. I'm not, but I think that it's one of the things that I seek at the heart of my personal spiritual inquiries, at the heart of my personal, at the heart of my path, you know, of my peculiar little sacrosanct path, is looking for this, you know, the broadest possible ecumenicism without doing it lazily, you see?
Without doing damage to the specificity.
All's the same thing anyway.
I would have to say the same thing to you. And I think I could say those words back to you with total genuineness. Now, whether they're the same, we're saying the same thing, I don't know. But I do know that St. John of the Cross, who's my go-to guy right now for the last year or year and a half, he makes a distinction between the intellect and the will. And you said something interesting about conceptual knowledge. And please, when I say conceptual knowledge, it includes words, but I'm not only speaking of language when we say conception. And we're talking about a whole milieu. Well, then St. John of the Cross gives this thing, well, you know, the will is based in love and action, and the intellect is based in knowledge. Mostly, don't keep feeding your intellect the way you do. You want to have knowledge in a certain way as to a thread that goes through all things, whereby you have the broadest, widest ecumenicism. Often, there needs to be a certain darkening of the intellect, if you will, or normal modes of knowledge, and a more of a submission to the will, submission to what the obedience of the moment. There is a way in which he describes this infusion through the will acting in love that then informs the intellect. It informs modes of knowing. It becomes a, this is, it's
sorry, it's on the periphery of my understanding. There's something about acting in accord with love somewhat blindly. I'm sorry, but not somewhat.
Well, and I wonder if it's not contradictory in some way. If there's some way of describing the same state, okay, what we would read in someone as the same state as a unification of intellect and will, where the intellect is no longer playing the role of this superficial train of thought that sits atop the vast sea of mind, producing currents that don't touch the depth wherein will and love reside, and that when one unites these, when one joins these, when the thoughts at the top of the ocean are indicative of the movements at the bottom, where will moves in line with intellect and intellect moves in line with will, and they're wedded such that maybe we wouldn't even use these words anymore, or maybe we wouldn't, it wouldn't seem right to use intellect. Maybe we'd seem feel so. As if we were equivocating, you know,
yeah,
to
you
use
might
the word
write,
intellect in such a
yeah,
state.
Yeah, well said. You might, you know, write a poem like The Living Flame of Love or The Spiritual Canticle or The Dark Night of the Soul. This poetry that came forth from St. John is precisely the goal is that unification in mm-hmm. God, what you just mm-hmm. laid out. He kind of lays out a methodology whereby what appears to be darkening of your intellect is a purification mm-hmm. and a whereby the unification of the will with the will of God, this sort of collusion of wills does work on the intellectual level the level of reason without which you cannot have mysticism. Unification is based upon reason. Not only is it not in contradiction, and I never mean to say that, and I'm glad you always pull us from the brink of what I would think would be an error. There are times, though, when the reason is quieted and you simply get up and take care of Ezra and you don't tit for, there's just a loving, willful act that then it actually allows the reason footing and confidence, because reason is being reflected in this active will to love.
If it's obvious or not, you know, but yeah. I was just raised in a certain way, you know, the path by which, you know, you and I came to this place where we sit before one another overlapped in some mm-hmm. ways and didn't in some ways. And I had, you know, a God-given gift, as it were, of an intellect that I was told not to use in spiritual pursuit. And so I have a natural defensiveness for that. And I'm, you know, a natural fear of those who have turned off that part of their mind solely wherein, you know, I dream of a place where we no longer know how to describe the line between will and intellect. Where to move one organ is to move the other, where you could never dream of moving any organ without all organs being in action.
It seems important to the masters to draw that distinction so that both faculties can be spoken of. I mean,
yes.
The extent to which mystics, when you actually get into mysticism, Islamic mysticism, whether it be Al-Ghazali, Fakhruddin Iraqi, Ibn al-Arabi, if you get into Taoist mysticism, Lao Tzu, Xuan Tzu, if you get into Christian mysticism, St. Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross, St. Thomas Aquinas, on and on, the reason is enshrined.
Yeah.
It's literally the without, so the notion of to think is to stink, which is, by the way, the hangover of the 60s and the 70s. Yeah. You feel it coming right. out of certain groups to yeah. think is to stink. Oh, now yeah. you're right. Now you're right in a way. Now, unreasonable thinking and unclear thinking definitely has a stench, and it leads to some pretty stinky behavior. But, oh my gosh, clear thinking can you lead you into the heart of unknowing and into the heart of poverty and into the heart of humility and into the heart of being available to the great spirit, to the like reasoning is, I mean, that is the very thing that distinguishes us, I believe. Mm-hmm. Reason connected with will from, you know, the tree lets her acorns fall and they create more trees. It's not, we can decide whether to have one tree or three. We have this whole other apparatus that distinguishes us precisely. That is what distinguishes us. Mm-hmm. And in lies our hope to me. So thanks for always holding on high the clear thinking. And you've helped me.
One of the most annoying things that I've heard said over and over again about reasoning is that somehow the only point of reason the only point of logic is to use it to realize the futility of logic, or the only point of reason is to come to the point where you realize the futility of logic realize the futility of reason. And what's frustrating to me is that there is something very profound in that. You see, to overstate it and say that that's the only reason for it, it's dumb. I mean, it's just false. It's just patently false and dumb and unnecessary.
But
to say that there is a state of reasoning wherein reason wraps in on itself, and you see that reason is built on what you see directly, or that trying to find some common ground upon which all reason is built, that reason reveals itself to exist as a premise which it could not itself buttress, having not yet been established by itself prior to its own existence. That it's a profound revelation. It is important. And to use will to step to reason and reason to step to will, to have that moment in the middle of the night.
There is no reality but God. To swing back and forth. It's almost.
And this is my child, and this moment is fleeting. And I should go because I should go, or I can go because I can go, because there is a heart is there, and my heart is here, and my heart is in the other room squeaking, and that it's an incredible privilege to go there. To think like it's fleeting, you know, to think. It's fleeting, you know. If that, I need that tool in the middle of the night to think.
Then reflecting on the reason itself. For me, it's more, or it can be and here, and it's like an architecture or a proportion. It's not that reason is let go of. It's that reason moves towards the summit as it gets clearer and more. And then there's a point at which you let go of the buttress, but you could never have gotten to that high stratosphere without her, without Shekhinah, without the wisdom light, without that which gives birth to Buddhas, without the prajnaparamita.
Is a metaphor too, you know, which perhaps we could just as easily describe as you have become that and no longer need to evoke what you are. That yes, clear
you've
thinking.
You've been birthed into that. You've been
that's
birthed
it.
In
now
that.
Hold a boat when you're a boat. You don't need to. you can swim. You know,
and yet the strange thing is in our heaven, I don't know your heaven, Ben, in Oakman, in the heaven of which there is no heaven higher, none higher, the highest ideal, the place of living there. Oh my gosh, it is built. It is, its edifices are built in my heart of reason. It is reason and that which is completely, you're right to say beyond reason, it doesn't, that's not doing justice to the unification you're alluding to in this talk. It's not, it doesn't do justice to, I think, your vision. I don't, but we're trying though.
Yeah, and I want to come to ecumenicism reluctantly. I want to be led there kicking and screaming.
Yeah,
I want to fight every step of the way.
Damn right.
When I arrive at a place in this life where I see that all paths point to the same heaven,
I want
to have arrived there reluctantly. I want to have fought it every step of the way and be helpless, but to admit finally, okay, I'm cornered. It seems that we all are helpless but to arrive in the same.
Yes, way. Yes. And it seems like, Ben, mystics like Al-Hafiz or Rumi, mystics like St. John, who seem to be drinking some kind of a different atmosphere, who feel in some way arrived at that point, do speak of an unknowing knowing, a knowing that was so bright it couldn't take a form. It couldn't, but it wasn't contradictory to form. Reason involves formality and form. It involves putting two things against each other and then compare it. It was there, but not being like whenever you hear it, it's like a knowing unknowing, an unknowing knowing, and then it seems kind of paradoxical. That is not the that's not the negation of reason. It's not the negation of logic. It's fruition. You can feel it. It's never a contradiction.
And I do want to believe, and I, you know, I demand to let you, you know, end this conversation today with some symmetry, it's not really necessary, but I like it. It makes me feel cute about these things.
Ezra.
That at the pinnacle of will and reason.
lies 2 a.m.
Yeah, right. Here is this child to be loved, and time is fleeting, and what higher honor, and the time will come. There was a time when there was not a person in the universe that I had this almost mystical power to comfort, and a time will pass when this mystical power is available to me, when there's no one left. That I have this unique mystical power, at least in this way, at least in this space, and this, you know, to
Amen.
To give comfort to, and right now it's like I'm a fucking wizard, I'm a priest, I'm a magician, I'm a superhero.
a druid,
I'm a druid,
a druid.
I'm dad, you know, I am this perfect sheen. You know, I am this, we are the deities of our children's eye, that the one, you know, the place of refuge, I am a refuge. And that's an indescribable honor, which is why we may spend an hour or so describing it in such detail. I love you, dude.
I love you, dude.
I'll talk to you soon. Thank you for spending this time with me.
I love you, bro.